Welcome to the Environmental Humanities podcast, sponsored by the Environmental Humanities Workshop at the Alice Kaplan Institute for the Humanities at Northwestern University. Our first guest is Jerry Z today. Jerry is assistant professor in the Princeton Environmental Institute and the Princeton University's Department of Anthropology. His articles appeared in Cultural Anthropology, American Anthropologist, and in various edited volumes. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, good morning. Good afternoon.
Also have a co-host, Corey Byrons, who is associate professor in the Department of Asian Languages and Cultures and the program in Comparative Literary Studies at Northwestern. Corey teaches courses in Modern Chinese Culture, Animal Studies, and the Environmental Humanities. His first book, Fixing Landscape, A Technopoetic History of China's Three Gorges, won the 2018 First Book Award from Columbia University's Weatherhead Institute for East Asian Studies and honorable mention for the 2020 Harry Levin Prize for Outstanding First Book in the Discipline of Comparative Literature from the American Comparative Literary Association. Welcome, Corey. It's nice to have you here.
It's nice to be here, Zainab. Thanks.
Jerry, I think you are one of the most exciting voices in anthropology that's emerged in the recent years, and your work is very intelligent and creative. Your writings about dust, sand, and sandstorms in China are able to link not only a broad range of disciplines, fields together, but also multiple matters of political concern, environmental concern, and ethical concern. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about your overall theoretical and research interests, and also how come you came to be interested in them.
Well, thank you for that lovely introduction. Yeah, I really appreciate that. Thank you. I'll try to live up to that. My research interests, as they've developed so far, and as they're sort of coalescing in a book that I'm working on right now, have to do with how to think about the relationship between environmental materiality as processual and changing, and how it interacts with sort of existing political experiments. And part of what I try to think through is whether the open-endedness of environmental process and the open-endedness of political process can be thought together. And so a lot of what I'm trying to think here is in asking how weather systems and political systems in particular interact. I got really into dust in the last, you know, I guess like 15 years ago, for a long time ago. After I had graduated from college, I lived and worked in China for a year. And I worked at an environmental NGO where, among other projects, they ran a large-scale tree planting project in Inner Mongolia, which is one of the places where I do field work. And I went there as I was thinking about applying to PhD school. And the idea behind these tree planting projects was not that they were meant to do local environmental remediation, which was, of course, part of it, but mostly because they were oriented toward landscapes downwind. So I started to think about how these questions of downwind and upwind relation, and especially the question of how do you think about environmental materiality, they were really confounding for me as someone who'd really been trained as a humanist, and thinking about how do you talk about this weird capacity of these very recent landscapes, like a new desert, which are forming all across northwestern China. How do you talk about that kind of geophysical process in a way that feels like it makes sense in relationship to, you know, some of the broad culturalist and sort of cultural studies kind of stuff that I was sort of trained on. So today my work sits kind of at the intersection of environmental anthropology and the environmental humanities, in feminist science and technology studies, and thinking a lot about sort of political systems in contemporary China.
Fascinating. And I think your work in that way also speaks to a streak in anthropology where you basically think about your materials and produce theory through the materials and the environments you engage with. And in an article, you also speak about sand as a theory machine, and you think through sand while theorizing the environment in contemporary China, which brings me to my second question. One of the things I found fascinating in your work, Jerry, and I'm referring to those two recent articles. One is very recent in American Anthropologist, and the other one, the 2017 article in Cultural Anthropology, is the way they rethink the concept of the environment and reconfigure it as something much more than the pacified site of technopolitical interventions and as a key actor that also shapes or gives form to technopolitics or temporal politics in China today and beyond. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about how you conceptualize environment and maybe speculate about how your interventions advance our understandings of the environment and the politics of nature in the field of anthropology, but also broadly in environmental humanities and STS.
It's a really good question, and it's one that grounds actually a lot of my work. A lot of my work turns on the question of how can we think about environment today as something more than a sort of passive backdrop to be mastered, right, or to be conquered. A lot of the way that I've gotten to kind of the sets of weird thinking that I've ended up with was thinking through a lot of my own training in anthropology, which is not environmentally focused, and thinking about a lot of kind of what at the time was sort of like hegemonic environmental history of China, all of which were kind of, inset in within this kind of like modernist argument in which you have a state and the way that you study that state is by showing that its approach to nature was one of sort of modernist domination, and would think through the question of nature primarily as a question of technical and political mastery and control. This is actually sort of one of the ideas that I went into the field with. I was trained in many ways as a political ecologist who was going out and trying to find sort of, making the argument that all of these things that we think about environment are really politics in other way, in different guises, right? But the idea sort of fell apart as I was actually kind of doing field work. A lot of my field work, early field work, was with environmental scientists and field ecologists and people of that, people who are interested in sand in all these different ways, and who are articulated in sort of complex ways with both sand dunes as specific kinds of formations with different kinds of properties and that could be manipulated in different ways. But also with, the Chinese Communist Party, most of the people that I work with were state environmental scientists who are card-carrying members of the Communist Party, right? Who really thought about the way in which their research was also articulated sort of very imperfectly with different kinds of state demands and goals, right? And so one of the things I started to notice all the time was just how much they talked about their complete inability to exert the kinds of technical political dominance over a pacifiable environment that I had been trained to kind of look for. And so very early on, I had to start thinking with them and taking them very seriously in terms of actually all the ways that the problem of environment materialized in their day-to-day work and in relationship to the way that they thought about what they were doing, right? And that sort of changed the way that I was thinking about the problem of environment, less as an object and more as this sort of set of problems and strategies and things that people were really thinking about all the time and then interacting with on a day-to-day basis, and what counted as environment and what counted as any particular material, for instance, sand, was many things all at once, none of which had any kind of clear guarantees or could easily be realigned into a sort of, an easy teleology in terms of how we think about the political horizons of either the state or the environment, right? So I guess there's a couple of ways that I've been really trying to think about what to do with the problem of environment and materiality, right? I think that I was trying to think through a lot of texts and papers and arguments that were kind of making the argument that, okay, well, the state wants to exert these forms of domination, but that never works because nature is active and has its own sets of demands, or it has its own sorts of, you know, the idea that nature is implicitly resistant to politics, right? Which is kind of a, like, you know, it's a bit of a romantic anti-state argument, right? And part of what I was sort of more interested in was, well, if you were to get yourself out of this binary of the state that tries to dominate and the nature that can't help but resist, well, how would environment matter, right? And as an anthropologist, I really tried to think through, well, how is materiality itself not transparent, but it's mediated through all these specific processes and knowledges and encounters through which scientists, for instance, come to know sand as many different things, some of which are in open conflict with others, right? And so this is kind of where I am. So in the Holding Patterns article, I'm trying to think about, you know, how environment shifts from this problem that needs to be sort of stabilized or controlled in one way or another into this set of weird forms that end up sort of patterning into the sort of high-flying statist kind of interventions that are ostensibly aimed at controlling it. And in the other article, Machine Sky, I'm really trying to think about, well, how, if environment is, again, not something to be straightforwardly dominated, does it become a sort of active principle in the sort of, how do you say this? Like, how does the physical environment as it sort of is enacted in all these different kinds of engineering pursuits come to matter as not the thing that they're trying to sort of hold in place, but as part of a broader matrix through which these different engineers are starting to understand what they're doing, right? So they think about themselves not only as acting into an environment, but being part of the environment as it unfurls, right? And so in those terms, you can imagine sort of, you know, small scale manipulations that scale up in all these different ways, but it's no longer just a question of like human life versus, you know, not humans, right? It takes all these other different shapes.
There's so much, Jerry and Zeynep, that you've already covered. But the thing that I was thinking about when you were speaking just now, Jerry, and having read the Holding Patterns article and having read your book manuscript, is a underlying sense of dissatisfaction and a refusal to accept the sort of easy paths, which are in some cases, when I speak of easy paths, these are already the results of refusals and disavowals of former conceptions of nature, for example. So oh, yeah. I'm thinking in particular of something like the Anthropocene concept, which has had a transformational impact in the field of the environmental humanities, has become a kind of, as you call it in your book, a charismatic mega category. And at the same time, I see in your writing a resistance to that concept and a refusal to be wrapped up in its logic. And I was hoping you could say a little bit more, building on what you've already said about environment, about the Anthropocene concept and how it figures in your work and what you're adding to it or how you're resisting it.
Thank you for that. I think it's a really important question. I think especially for folks who are more broadly sort of involved in the environmental humanities and different kinds of environmental fields and have to have some sort of account of this question, right? And so I think that it's both a question of refusing and yet also not being able to refuse, right? And I guess maybe one way that I would think about this question in kind of an oblique way, but I'm going to answer it, I promise. And is that different people who are very closely involved in thinking about desertification, land degradation, and dust storm formation think about how things work in the world, in the physical world. And so when an alien physicist, a physicist who thinks about the relationship, the fluid dynamics of sand and wind, sees a sand dune, for instance, they don't see simply a question of fixity and stability. They don't see simply a question of moving and not moving, like binary terms. They see in that sand dune all the different possible shapes that that could take under different conditions, right? They have a kaleidoscopic imaginary of materiality, right? And it helps me think about a geometry of argumentation and possibility in approaching things that isn't about just accepting or refusing, but in taking something and then seeing what other shapes it could morph into, right? One of the things that's sort of at the center of the way that I think in the book is a figure of phase shift, which is a geophysical language for talking about how materials can figure into other shapes, right? And so when I'm thinking about the Anthropocene and also other giant charismatic metacategories, I lift that phrase from Beth Reddy. For instance, you could ask the same thing from a different angle about, like, you know, how are you thinking about the Chinese government or something like that, right? Like these giant things that can't be refused. My reaction is to think, well, there has to be a way of asking the question through this term, that there are ways of asking the question of what planetary relation looks like specifically from within specific political traditions, within specific experimental traditions, within specific material questions, right? And so I think that I try to approach the Anthropocene as something else, right? But just like to reiterate, it's neither about accepting it on its terms or refusing it altogether, right? And I think that part of what I learned from these folks who are just thinking with sand and wind and dust all the time is that you can approach something in terms of all the configurations that are already possible imminently. And the work is not in making a decision, an argument, a polemic about one thing or another, but in tracing the lines that things could become, right? And then trying to manipulate the course in which that would shape.
Thank you, Jerry. So in the same article, Holding Patterns, you write about how sand gives form to a way of thinking time. And I think what's most striking in this account is the way that sand and its shifting materialities become a medium through which people remember the past, but also gesture towards a kind of near future. And as you write, thinking time through sand also challenges these contemporary narratives of environmental change that mark the future as doomsday or an ending. So your account, I think, in this way provides a solid critique of the temporal assumptions of the Anthropocene thesis. So I was wondering if you could tell us more about that.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I think that part of it, part of the question and challenge and also the sort of affordance of being an ethnographer in particular to think through these questions, or anybody who really wants to think closely with detail or something like that, is the only way that I can answer this question is starting sort of at that scale, right? I was thinking a lot about thinking about the problem of history, right? And the way that I was thinking that was like, well, this is a way of asking a question of how do you tell geological and human time together, right? How do you think the relationship between geology and history? And in the early part of my fieldwork, when I was working at an environmental and ecological field station out in a desertified region of northeastern Inner Mongolia, and I was going every morning, getting into the van with the folks who are going out and doing running different kinds of experiments, collecting different kinds of things, we would drive past all different kinds of landscapes. In the place that I was working, you had next to sort of fields that were undergoing active desertification or land degradation. You'd have that next to sort of newly opened cornfields, and you would see that next to, you know, quote unquote pristine grassland and this sort of thing. You would see this real sort of alternation of physical environments. And the way that the ecologists that I was hanging out with would talk about this and explain it to me over and over again was that all of these landscapes could be related to each other as part of an ongoing social and historical cycle, right? And so every time we came across a devastated field, they would say that, well, if you just wait 150 years, that's going to be a grassland again, right? And the time scale through which they could articulate this future, where it was very easy to think about things that were 150 years from now, was also sort of mirrored in the opposite direction, right? Because they would talk basically about archaeological evidence that was inset within this idea that China has been around for just a really, really, really long time, right? And so one is only ever in the midst of an unbroken cycle of change, right? And I started to think about what the relationship between that, how you could think about these large scale processes of landscape change that already have a theorization of what people are doing, right? All of these things have to do with different modes of using the land. And starting to think about that as like, well, this is also a way in which people are talking about the convergence of large, long scale ecological time and, you know, what people are doing on sort of, you know, a historical basis, right? And so as I started to think through that and I started to do more of my field work, I just really started thinking about, well, there are all these ways that people are using landscapes to tell time. And at the time, there were all these arguments that, well, it's an Anthropocene question at that time, right? Because I was trying to think about all these people who are arguing that the Anthropocene means that you're seeing this convergence. I'm thinking especially of like Dipesh Chakrabarty, but people who are making the argument that you see the convergence of historical and geological timescales in the Anthropocene. And this means that we have to somehow start thinking about other ways of what was particularly jarring to me about the sort of large scale, like that idea of like long-term landscape change and cycling was that it was so distinct from the sort of the ideal of like infinite coming development that was part of the grand state narrative, right? The way that the circles lined up with these straight lines was really compelling to me. And so what ended up happening in that article was that I got really interested in all the ways that the straight line of statist futurity would bend if you just started to think with all these people who are just dealing with sand on a day-to-day basis, right? About that question, right? And so what's happening there is basically you have all these people who are going out in the landscape and finding things that are neither. They're thinking closely with basically how sand moves as a geophysical, ecological material, and giving you ways of talking about all these weird timelines that spin out that imply the state in all these different ways and don't end up in the same kind of sort of irredeemable environmental endpoint either that we're kind of used to with thinking about the Anthropocene, right? Yeah. So like it's like, how do you tell a story through a material that admits neither endings nor sort of teleological endpoints? Right?
Jerry, that example you give of the conversation you had during your fieldwork is so fascinating. And I'm wondering to what extent your interlocutors, the people you were working with and spending time with, shared that viewpoint, whether there was a sense of a shift from a teleological kind of socialist pre-reform sense of temporality that drove the developmental state, a sense of a shift from that mentality to what you're describing as cyclical and what could be thought of as, and in other contexts, could certainly be described as a revival of an almost imperial kind of cyclicality, which is very obvious, you know, at the moment.
Yes. Yeah, I think that's also, it's like such a good thing to keep in mind, right? Because I think that part of what's also happening in that notion of the revival of cyclical time is that, well, it's just so clear how the fantasy of an ever-renewing socio-natural cycle, which is like so closely part of certain kinds of environmental thinking and optimism right now, also becomes a way of thinking just a huge number of cliches about the way that the Chinese state works, right? And I think that it's like, it was interesting to me that the cliches would find their, like the cliche of like an eternal cycling Chinese dynastic or political system would find itself repeated in this way of talking about the transition of grasslands to farmlands to desert, right? It was just like very strange to me, right? And I think that thinking with that strangeness is really both captivating and animating for me as a way of grounding a certain kind of thinking into time, right? But I don't know exactly what's happened, because I think that, so that example is really good for me to think with, in that it sort of allows the Anthropocene temporality question to be asked in a very specific way, right? But I think that, you know, part of the animating challenge of this kind of work is to think, you know, about actually how complexly people think about sort of the problem of time, right? Even scientists who we think are going to be trained to think about, you know, sand and its futures in one way can balance at the same time, can think about the convergence of multiple timelines, all of which, none of which actually line up with one another, right? One of the things that I'm really interested in that article is not just saying that there are these different multiple things, but that they juxtapose and interact in these different ways, right? So I don't know. And I think that I don't know what the political stakes of this fantasy of cyclical, endless cyclical return are, especially in a moment like this, right? Where I think that you're very right to point out that I think that we are in this moment in which the Chinese future is bending in a way that can't easily be accounted for through like the sort of reform idea of infinite economic development anymore, right? And so I wonder, I'll ask it as an open kind of question. I don't know, right? I wonder what the relationship then, like, I think that the terms of the relationship between the straight line and the cycle are changing again, right? But I will say also that a lot of the scientists that I was working with at this moment also, because ecology and ecological and landscape change is only one way of understand landscapes and time there, right? So the other thing that they were continually talking about was that Inner Mongolia is now and was at the time the top coal producing province in China. It was undergoing a massive economic boom. And so there were lots of questions, environmental worries that people had that couldn't be subsumed into the cycle, right? So for instance, the major one that people were having was falling water tables and groundwater pollution, which is an effect of large-scale extractive industry. And that's something that I bracket in this moment, but I think it's really important to introduce that basically as a way of tempering the expectation that, well, you know, there are only two ways of thinking about this problem, right?
Well, thank you, Jerry. You're also giving me a lot to think about in relation to environmental politics in Turkey and fantasies of Ottoman Empire reversal and eternal return and the 7,000-year-old Turkish state and so on. So there are interesting parallels. So I want to congratulate you on your new book titled Continent in Dust, Experiments in a Chinese Weather System, upcoming from the University of California Press. Yay. So would you tell us about the premise of the book a little bit and the impact you hope it will make in our fields?
Oh yeah, of course. Yeah, thank you for that. And I accept those congratulations. I'm really excited about it. Before I start, I think that there's a lot of people that I have to thank for helping me get to the point where I can talk and think about the book. So Corey is one of those people who's put in an inordinate amount of time talking to me about this whole thing. The book is an ethnography of strange weather in the way that I talk. So I think about the book as an ethnography of strange weather. It's oriented around this sort of very specific environmental meteorological emergence of the last several decades, which is that China, northern China in particular, has developed a massive seasonal dust storm problem. Which is the effect of decades of inland land degradation, and this, one of the effects of large scale inland land degradation is that every now and then, when the wind blows just the right way, a landscape can become a storm cloud, right? And so, part of what I'm interested in this book is thinking about how, in the sort of trajectory of a dust storm, both geographical, in that dust storms, the dust storms that I'm interested in start in Inner Mongolia and then work their way through Beijing and then work their way across the South Korean peninsula, the Korean peninsula and Japan, and then eventually distribute over the Pacific Ocean. Sometimes the big ones land in the Western United States and even further. So you have the geographical trajectory of a dust storm, but you also have the geophysical trajectory, in which you see as a dust storm moves, it actually passes through all these different phases of matter, right? All of which are sort of different iterations of the relationship between sand and wind and ultimately the state. And so I'm interested with thinking about how dust storms in these complex material and political ways work, right? And how they orient particular kind of open-ended experimental politics in which sort of what we think about as authoritarianism, as like a kind of rigid structure, especially in the China of now, really opens itself up to becoming experimental in its form and in its attempt both to try to figure out how to manage the landscapes where these large-scale dust storms are coming from, and also the kinds of political experiments that take shape when one's contemporary is oriented through something like aerosols, right? And so the book has three parts. In the first section, I write about all the kinds of, a couple of sort of governmental and political experiments that are happening in the Chinese interior, which have been sort of reimagined from Beijing as sites where dust storms come from. And so I'm interested in how the question of land degradation, which is a local problem, a problem of local ecological devastation, becomes upscaled into a problem of someone else's weather patterns. And then thinking about a couple environmental interventions that really imply the entirety of social and economic life also are sort of more mobilized to deal with these in a kind of experimental way. And the second section, I'm interested in large-scale particulate matter catastrophes in Beijing in particular. And I think about that in a couple of different ways. But the reason that matters is because the political substance of Beijing's atmosphere, not just as a polluted place, but as a place that has all these different kinds of particulate questions. And particulates are interesting in particular as a way of thinking through atmospheric questions. They really matter, not only in terms of how the center's relationship with its borderland peripheries are transforming, but in terms of all the ways in which people are trying to reimagine the conditions and possibilities of political life. And one of the arguments that I make is that, well, this doesn't fall easily into either a revival of some earlier socialist model, nor does it portend some coming democratic sort of revival or revolution, right? In the last section, I consider dust as it moves kind of beyond Chinese borders. And so I think with these South Korean planting teams that start in Seoul and then fly to the middle of the desert in China to do these planting projects, and really I'm trying to ask the question of how do you think about, in all these sections, I'm trying to ask the question of, you know, how do you think about these weather systems as they are ramifying as ways of, in ways that people are actively reflecting and intervening and making a Chinese present. Right? And in the last section, I really trace the dusts as they scatter over the Pacific and they create new kinds of political relations and also different kinds of ecologies as they settle.
That's great, Jerry. I read the manuscript already, but I still have so many questions. And hearing you redescribe it in that way, I'm coming up with more questions. I have two in particular. One I'll set aside for now, and if we have time, I can ask it. But the first one is one that you probably have been asked a couple of times, and that is why weather and not climate? Mm-hmm. You talk, you know, I think eloquently and convincingly about why you're writing about weather and not pollution. But I was hoping you could say a little bit more about why you're talking about weather or focusing on weather rather than climate. And as a corollary to that, and as a sort of invitation to kind of spin out in your thinking, which I know that, you know, you like to do. I have another question closely related, which is the book, you know, moves towards through these phase shifts and changes across the Pacific to the West Coast of the United States. And so there's this incredible geographic scope to the project, which seems to encourage a climate style of thinking if we treat weather as a more local phenomenon and climate as a larger scale kind of collection of weather events interacting. And so I'm curious to know, one, okay, the climate question, but then two, what I couldn't help but think about your project recently in the context of fires on the West Coast. When I was recently on the East Coast and I looked up into the sky and the sun was a copper disc and I could see the ash and the particulate matter from fires across the continent. And there's a sense of that shifting of a change in matter, right? In this case, of from wood to ash and to smoke, but also that movement that seems to be a signal of changing climate. And so I'm curious to know if you had thoughts on these contemporary events and how you connect them to the book project.
I mean, I'd love to consider thinking, I mean, I'd love to talk more about this because I actually don't have a very good answer for this, right? I think that I could venture some of them. And the answers that I do have, I think are a little bit unsatisfactory even to me, right? Because I think that they play into some old tropes of basically how ethnography works as a disciplinary question, right? The immediate thing that I think of is that, like, I needed weather and not climate because I needed to talk about, because ethnographic work compels reflection on events and not in a more amenable way than it does on statistical sort of irregularities or something, right? And so weather gave me a much more material way of focusing, at least for me methodologically, a kind of trajectory of things, places, and objects that I would think about together, right? Now, that's a real problem, I think, in some ways, right? Because I think that the climate question entails... It ends up being a sort of question of what ethnography can attend to, right? And I think that at this point, I don't have a good way of dealing with the question of how do you study something that is happening but is not happening, you know, like something that clearly must be going on but can't be localized in some way, or it can't be crystallized into some kind of event, right? And I think that there are all sorts of problems with this because it means that ethnography and the way that I'm thinking about it can only talk about the disaster and not its necessary conditions, right? In some ways. And so, I don't know. I mean, part of my resistance also to climate is that I think that there's something overdetermined about the way that climate can exist in this moment as a political and ethnographic object, right? And weather gave me a way of talking and tracing things out that maybe could skirt some of the necessary polemics that I think are kind of involved in that, right? And I think it's something that I'm thinking about all the time in terms of, like, what is the point of writing, right? What is the point of writing in environmental fields, right? And I think that I wanted to find a way of charting a way of talking about the things that we think about as being climatically related without necessarily having to fall into some of the kind of ruts and the grooves of that kind of argument, right? Well, that said, I do appreciate, I think that, like, you know, I think the best thing that I can say also is that, like, in some way, the traditional distinction between weather and climate, like, conceptually is breaking down, I think, in the sense of just, like, the way that people talk about it and the way that it gets studied, especially in the sort of humanistic social sciences at this point, right? Where I think it's probably not enough to be able to say that climate is a set of statistical regularities that can only be tracked in the large scale, right? I think that that's really not especially analytically operable for the moment that we're sort of talking about right now, especially if one of the major sort of epistemic experiential problems of climate change is that it makes that kind of statistical regular projection almost impossible to do, right? And so, yeah, that's how I would respond to that. I don't really know, right? Because I think that, but I'll tell you where the difficulty is, right? And it has to do with whether there's a way of doing environmental ethnography that can attend better to slow violences rather than sort of disasters, right? And I think that part of what I'm trying to think about with weather, what I like about weather is that it really skirts that divide between the disastrous and the mundane. And you can talk about it both through these spectacular events of sort of dust fall and pollution. But ultimately, I think where I try to go with it is try to think about how it's configured through, and it configures very specific experiences of living in a certain kind of atmospheric and geophysical contemporary that is by definition also political and a social economic contemporary. And I think that gets me a little bit closer and in a more faithful way to, I think that what I think I was doing when I was doing field work and when I was thinking through it. But I don't know, because, you know, I think that right now where I'm getting hung up in the question, I think it's so helpful to think about is that, like, the relation, the distinction between weather and climate can't be the distinction between local specific and global abstract or something anymore, right? And so, yeah.
One of the ways in which we are encouraged to view and think about China in the United States, and I think also to a certain extent in Europe and other parts of the world, certainly in Southeast Asia, is as a threat.
Yes.
A political threat, an economic threat, a military threat, and in particular, an environmental threat.
Yes.
And that, you know, this is something we've talked about and I've written about. And your book talks a little bit about the anxieties that emerge when these dust events, when Chinese weather becomes global, or when the sort of matter of the Chinese state becomes aerosol, travels across the Pacific, and degrades air quality in places like LA, San Francisco, Denver, etc. And so I want to know if you're, how you're writing about it or thinking about that anxiety about China as an environmental threat has evolved over the last 5 or 6 months, not only in the context of a kind of rampant anti-Chinese sentiment and racism as a result of COVID, I guess in particular that, and whether you see kind of affinities between that, and I guess ways of making connections between a sense of these threats that travel, that are amorphous, that even the Pacific can't protect us from?
It's such a good question, right? And I think anxiety is probably the right word for it, both in terms of the way that it plays out politically outside of China, and also as an anxiety for those who write and think with and in China, right? I think that there's, for like, even before these 5 or 6 months, but I'll get back to that, I think that there's, it's very difficult to write, especially about how the Chinese state works, because you're wading into like decades, if not centuries, of this kind of weird tradition in which you neither want to, like, you have the full weight of every Orientalist representation and then Cold War representation of China, anxiety, and that sort of is in the background. I think that one of the things that I would say, and I think that has not changed my mind over the last 5 or 6 months, but I think has really emphasized and clarified some things, is that it's absolutely, so our inability to think through this anxiety is our inability to be able to attend to the sets of relations through which all life and being on this planet is constituted, right? And so I think that there is something politically productive, for instance, in calling it a Chinese virus, you know, against all the xenophobic stuff, right? Because if that China doesn't designate only the source of an incoming threat, but the name of a consequential relation through which, you know, basically all arenas of contemporary life and future life on this planet are going to be held through, right? And I think that there's a space for environmental thinking and attention within the thicket of blame and geopolitics for asking how we could attend to these inevitable and in this and already like non-optional relations, right? The planetary system is already locked into the sets of feedbacks that are going to be constantly generating these kinds of novel events, right? And the way that our economic system works does the same. And I think it's important to be able to name those relations and do exactly the opposite of the right wing thing, right? And to think about what it means to live in a world where vulnerability is the very condition of our existence, and vulnerabilities are heightened because of all the terrible ways that our social and natural worlds are organized under current regimes, right? And so I think it's really important, right? Because I think that the other trap is basically to fall into this thing where every time someone makes an environmental critique of China, where in fact terrible things are happening in the environment, it becomes this thing where, well, the US does it worse, which is often true, right? But not always. And I think that does nothing but reproduce a certain set of geopolitical scripts that we're very used to dealing with. And it does nothing for thinking about what planetary crisis entails and will become of us, right? And I think this is really, I mean, in the last 5 or 6 months is a way of asking the question of what does it mean that we are, that we're, you know, what does it mean for, to live on a planet where we're all dying together, right? As, and that's one way of sort of, I don't know, thinking about a specific, thinking specifically through maybe what the Anthropocene is, right? Like, as the, you know, yeah, as all the things that have to happen so that we can die a little bit better and with a little bit more care. And I think, I don't know, and that's where we are. That's where I think, right? And so when I think about the large, sort of like the incoming dusts and all that sort of thing, it's in one way with a certain kind of amazement, right? In terms of all the ways that, you know, our very biology and ecology in distant places is already being transformed through these relationships that are only just, we only just have the barest glimmer of a way to account for. And we can only just begin to start accounting for that, right? And I don't know what happens next, but I think, yeah, I think that we're in a place where we have to be able to account for that, right? And the other thing is that we have to be able to ask a question, I think, like I'm trying to ask in this book, which is like, is there a way that environmental processes matter, to our accounting for the way that political and geopolitical relationships unfurl, right? And for more on that, you can read chapter 6 of the book, because this is the actual conversation that some of these Korean NGOs are having as they negotiate their relationship with large scale land degradation in China that eventually floats over to become their sky, right? And ask whether there's a way to do that without falling into a familiar politics of geopolitical blame.
Are you working on a new project?
COVID. No, I'm not. I'm in this moment where for the first time in a long time, I've been free to think about new stuff, which is very exciting. So a lot of my interests right now are drifting over to, on the one hand, thinking about different kinds of artificial intelligence and how they configure states of neither living nor death in China. So that's a question. And I think about that and specifically through, the technicalization of suicide in China. So I've been trying to think about that a little bit. And then all this stuff, I mean, I've been, one of the things I did over COVID was that I got really into the work of this one artist. And so I wrote a paper about her work, and that is going to be coming out at some point as a chapter in a book. An artist named Alana Halperin, who does geological art and really thinks with thinking about geological and using geological processes of accretion and sedimentation, and trying to think about how that kind of artistic geological practice can give us ways of thinking about relation and agency that can be helpful in the environmental humanities. Yes, other stuff like that, just all over the place. Who knows?
Thank you, Jerry, for a fascinating conversation today.